Do you want to come in?
I believe it does.
Well, then, come on.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, dear listeners, fellow writers, scribblers in the margins of library books, juvenile delinquents, and cartographers of the broken terrain of the human psyche, to Episode 8. On today's Odyssey, I'll be talking to the lovely Ashley Nguanta, whose chapbook, The Way Home, will be coming out soon. Randall Burling will exhume what Roger Corman did to the works of Edgar Allan Poe. And in the mailbag segment, I'll define masculinity in about 5 minutes. Hint, men like breasts and women who smile. Just recently, the Orlando Weekly named the 15 Views of Orlando project the city's best mirror. Who was in that book? Oh yes, I was, and so was Ashley Nguanta, come to think of it. The book was edited by Nathan Hollick, who masterfully read this week's memoir essay about Corman's Poe films. Nathan also appeared with Ryan Rivas on Episode 1 to talk about the 15 Views project. Many thanks to Orlando Weekly. All right, now with that little bit of news out of the way, rather than just tell you what I've been writing and what I've been publishing this week, I've got something a little bit more serious to say, and this is going to take, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, and if it starts to bore you, well then just please fast forward so that you can get to the wonderful conversation that I had with Ashley Nguanta. So last weekend, as I expect you know, there was a massacre in Colorado. James Holmes, a troubled PhD student in neuroscience, turned a screening of The Dark Knight Rises into a scene of terror that could have appeared in The Dark Knight Rises. Dressed in ballistic gear, including a helmet from which his colorful hair could be seen, he stepped to the front of the theater, rolled 2 gas canisters onto the floor, and then opened fire. He killed 12 people and injured 58 more. There's a reason why I'm bringing it up on this podcast, dear listeners. I'm not going to offer any cringeworthy political stances, nor am I going to dwell on the emotional pornography of the spectacle of the victims or of the horror of the killer. Not much, anyway. So this horrific occurrence led to the typical outpouring of mental diarrhea from people speaking like they had the madness of this thing figured out. Journalists. Pundits. My neighbors. What I didn't expect is a total mind fart from Bill Maher, who I admire for his political courage, his intellectual curiosity, and his sense of humor when he looks at the human condition. The day after the massacre, though, he posted this on the Facebook page for his television show. There were death threats to critics who panned Batman, a movie. Half this country thinks everything can be solved by threats, guns, bombing. And by the way, fact that quote, serious, unquote, critics treat a fucking Batman movie as a profound comment on the human condition says a lot about our, quote, unquote, culture. The first part of the comment about film critics is actually in response to another story. Marshall Fine, who is a critic for a website called Hollywood and Fine, which I and probably you have never heard of, received over 900 death threats over his negative review of The Dark Knight Rises. I sort of wish Bill Maher had taken down this comment when the James Holmes things happened, although Bill Maher's comment already had thousands of comments from other Facebook users in no time at all. Who in their right minds is typing in the 2,000th comment about one of Bill Maher's comments, I wonder? Who do they think is reading that? But I digress. I hadn't even heard of the Michael Fine thing. For a lot of people, such as myself, it wasn't even a story, which is a problem, I think. Fine was getting death threats from people who couldn't even have seen the movie yet. The death threats weren't about a movie. Not really. But in the second part of his statement, Bill Maher sounds like a cranky, out-of-touch old person. Once again, here's what he said. And by the way, fact that, quote, serious, unquote, critics treat a fucking Batman movie as a profound comment on the human condition says a lot about our, quote, unquote, culture. Bill Maher is 56, and so perhaps he imagines that comic book stories can only be about men who are suffocating under the mass of their own muscles, dressed in colorful underpants and capes and jackboots, who slap the crap out of each other over nondescript cityscapes. It would be understandable if he missed out on the radical evolution of comic books that happened in the 1980s and is still ongoing. Writers and artists like Frank Miller, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Tag McKeever, and Art Spiegelman were not just writing down to kids, but writing up to them, and not just to kids, either. In part, this is why writers, great novelists such as Michael Chabon, Junot Diaz, Jonathan Lethem, and Rick Moody all see profound value in the imaginative possibilities and cultural reference of comic books. By the way, Jonathan Lethem, who was my teacher for one semester at NYU, has a remarkable piece in the latest Rolling Stone about why Batman is so appealing, why Batman is so entrenched in the American psyche. It's brilliant, beautiful writing. The man is still teaching me. When I was a teenager in high school, back in the 1980s, when dinosaurs roamed the earth, I came upon the new comic book revolution, and among my friends and I, that, along with the blues, along with philosophy, helped us to endure our great alienation as the losers of our culture. The odd thing about high school is that it alarmingly has the texture of reality, despite how superficial everything is. Of course, nearly everyone in high school has some feeling of alienation, including the cheerleaders and the football players who are terrified of becoming losers. But their alienation is not the same as that of the losers, the weirdos themselves. This was before comic books were considered cool, by the way. We quoted The Dark Knight Returns to one another and flew our freak flags as high as we could. What disappointed me about Bill Maher's ad hominem slamming of comic books is that he demonstrated that he doesn't know how to read them. What I saw, and in some ways still see in comic books, is apparently invisible to Bill Maher. I've never heard him argue that Alan Moore has nothing to say, or even Frank Miller, who has lately become so reactionary that he's the Ted Nugent of the comic book community. This invisibility matters, and is related to the shootings in Colorado, in my humble opinion. One of the unspeakable ironies is that the audience at that Aurora Cinema didn't recognize the danger until he opened fire, because his presence seemed plausibly part of the show. I've read two different reports about James Holmes' surrender to the police. One report said that he had identified with the Joker, but another report indicated that he had said something more explicitly like, "I am the Joker." The photos of him that appeared seemed to bear the latter report out, since he had a placid, vacant, Cupid doll smile in them. Here's an easy confession to make. I thought The Dark Knight was a pretty terrible story. Batman isn't interesting. Bruce Wayne isn't interesting. Maggie Gyllenhaal, who can be entrancing, was dull. The plot was too technical and didn't probe the morality of his characters enough. Chris Nolan basically failed. But none of that mattered because of Heath Ledger and whoever did his makeup. Ledger won a posthumous Oscar, and the image of him as the Joker was profound. Here's why. The Joker exposes the nightmare of American positivism. It's the scarring smile of coerced optimism for false ideals and false systems, and it's shitting directly onto the egos of everyone who thinks he has the answer. The Joker is a compelling but very sick test of a very sick system. If you see the sickness, if you address the sickness, and refuse to be invisible, then you are, ironically, a freak. As the Joker says to Batman, "You're a freak. Like me." The cinema massacre happened about 20 miles away from Columbine, Colorado, where two alienated boys went on a killing spree in their high school back in 1999. One sentiment that appeared right after Columbine was an incredulous one. How could anything like this have happened? The boys were insane monsters, obviously. Blame Marilyn Manson. And the next sentiment, we have to make sure this never happens again. It always happens again. I wish it didn't, but it does. When people said, "How could this have ever happened?" I knew exactly how it could have happened. Boys who have no visions of a meaningful future for their lives decide not to go the route of the quiet, hopeless losers who give in to despair and privately kill themselves, making their invisibility permanent. Instead, they go out with a bang. I say this not with any approval. When I'd spoke to a friend about this, a friend of mine, a woman who is an amazingly good writer and impressive scholar, the nicest woman I know, a woman with a good husband and two wonderful daughters. She said sullenly, "Why can't we go back to the days when those weird kids just killed themselves quietly?" The world is filled with more information, more pieces of data than we can process at once. There is more, really, than we can process in a lifetime. I'm reminded of the outraged Penn State fans who turned out to witness the removal of the statue of Joe Paterno, the famed coach who was disgraced when it was revealed that he covered up for one of his assistant coaches, who has just been officially convicted many times over as a pedophile. Penn State President Rodney Erickson said, "I believe that, were it to remain, the statue would be a recurring wound to the multitude of individuals across the nation and beyond who have been the victims of child abuse." But those who convened at the statue's removal felt differently. I'm going to quote from a Yahoo article here about two people who resented what was happening. Clarissa Turner, who drove up from Martinsville, Virginia, to see the statue, clasped her hand over her mouth when she saw the statue was gone. "He's done so much for this university. It's sad," she said. "To wipe it all away is like he meant nothing." "I think it was an act of cowardice on the part of the university," said Mary Trometter of Williamsport, who wore a shirt bearing Paterno's image. She said she felt betrayed by university officials, saying they promised openness but said nothing about the decision until just before the removal work began. To address Clarissa Turner's concern, Joe Paterno did so much for the university. He coached the school's football team to an almost legendary number of victories over the years, including a lot of bowl games. Some of his teams were undefeated. Twice he coached the team to national championships. These are athletic achievements that the whole university could celebrate, that make its alumni and students and children who might someday become Lions share together there in Beaver Stadium. And the assistant coach fucked little boys, using the aegis of Penn State to attract them. And the coach, Joe Paterno, protected himself in the sense of school spirit by looking the other way, by letting the violated boys be invisible. To address Mary Trometter's concern, using the word cowardice now to describe the decision of Penn State after Jerry Sandusky was convicted of 45 counts of sexual molestation of minors that the university allowed to happen indicates a set of values that is simply diseased. It's what's called denial, really. Do we have to remember that Jerry Sandusky raped children? Do we have to remember that Joe Paterno, this paternally named perfect dad, let it happen? Only if you're willing to admit that the rape of young boys is okay. Only if you are content to live as a sick person in a sick world. And millions of people are that content, I'm afraid. The statue that was removed featured a triumphant Joe, his finger victoriously pointed to the sky, as generic football players emerged from the concrete side of Beaver Stadium. Presumably, there are other statues buried in the framework. I say this not to be politically provocative or to be self-righteous. The point I am trying to make is one about writing. A question we always hear after really evil events come to pass is, why didn't anyone see this coming? Surely the lunatic must have shown signs. The answer, let's just see things sooner, is almost always stupid. Perhaps Michelle Bachmann is too stupid to use as a general example here, but let's go. She has expressed her desire to protect the Constitution by violating the Constitution to go on a witch hunt for terrorist Muslims in the government on the suspicion that they are terrorists because, ahem, they are Muslim. This illiteracy, the most vocal protectors of the Constitution prove over and over again that they don't understand it, is systemic. Gun control activists swiftly tried to leverage this Colorado shooting as evidence that stricter gun laws are needed. Maybe. The NRA and Second Amendment advocates swiftly responded with statements about the sanctity of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights consists of 10 amendments to the Constitution, which by their very existence prove that Constitution is not a perfect document. The 18th Amendment, which is a loathsome thing to us here at the Drunken Odyssey, made alcohol illegal to drink in this country. The 21st reversed that grotesque attack on American liberty. The 21st Amendment, dear listeners, is our second favorite amendment right after the First Amendment. But the 21st Amendment is yet more evidence that an amendment is not a permanent change to an unchangeable document. The Second Amendment says, and I quote, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." To Second Amendment advocates, the first 12 words of the fucking amendment, almost half of the fucking text itself, are invisible. No meaningful dialogue about this amendment can be had without discussing the role of militias. The idea of the Second Amendment is that militias are needed either to repel invaders of our country or to mount an insurrection against our government should it turn tyrannical. The amendment was written before we had a standing Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, and Coast Guard. If people want assault rifles and infinite amounts of ammo in order to take on the U.S. Army if they feel the need to, let's have this argument. Let's have this discussion. A militia can't win that fight, or at least I highly doubt it, but perhaps a militia has a right to that fight. Except we can't have the discussion. As a nation, we can't read the Second Amendment. Half of it is invisible. And I think it's this state of being mentally asleep that leads to prejudice, that leads to us socially erasing people who make us uncomfortable, that leads to a deepening alienation, that leads to destructive decisions. Martin Luther King once wrote, "Nothing pains some people more than having to think." One of the segments I feature on this show is called "A Book That Saved My Life." It's not appropriate for every book, but it's appropriate for a lot of them. Books can make us feel less alone. They can affirm that if we are freaks, we are not the only ones. They can affirm sometimes that we, no matter who we are not invisible. Even comic books can do this. This helps explain why people threaten the life of a little-known film reviewer who disliked a movie they haven't even seen. I haven't seen The Dark Knight Rises yet, but Marshall Fine is perhaps right to think the movie isn't especially good. He is certainly entitled to his opinion. But to thousands of comic book fans who see these characters as metaphors, as the elements of a life of moral engagement, and as emblems of their own identity, such a dismissal might sound like the threat of becoming invisible. Assholes, by their very behavior, aren't invisible. Look at Donald Trump. And I'm sure that I'm an asshole some of the time, perhaps all the time, probably at the very least right now. But as writers, we have a responsibility. Virginia Woolf spoke of this eloquently in what is perhaps her best short essay, Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown. The gist of her essay is that if three writers see a working-class woman on the train, those three writers will produce three different characterizations of her. Two out of the three writers will have some narrative predispositions, and so characterize her in ways that help their stories. The third, Virginia herself in this case, understands that Mrs. Brown, the working-class woman, is an actual person, and so her characterization shouldn't be molded to fit a theme or a message. The story needs to be molded to the writer's best efforts to understand Mrs. Brown on her own terms. Wolf says, "Do not expect just at present a complete and satisfactory presentment of her. Tolerate the spasmodic, the obscure, the fragmentary, the failure. Your help is invoked in a good cause, for I will make one final and surpassingly rash prediction. We are trembling on the verge of one of the great ages of English literature, but it can only be reached if we are determined never, never to desert Mrs. Brown." It was a great age. Perhaps the importance of comic books means that age is over, but I am not convinced. The important thing is that as writers we try, no matter what genre, no matter what venue, to tell the truth and to help people see the world, including the people in the world we might prefer were invisible. What does this massacre mean? What does this madness mean? Maybe as the failure of his academic career became unbearably embarrassing, James Holmes found being the Joker more tolerable than being himself. Maybe this business means nothing. Maybe understanding madness is, as Polonius says, the same thing as being mad. Maybe. But as writers, we have an obligation to be mentally awake and to try to understand.
And now, the interview of the day.
I'm joined today in the Whisper Room with Ashley Nguanta, who is the author of The Way Home, soon to be published by Dancing Girl Press. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
You're one of the luminaries of the Orlando literary scene. Congratulations on the publication. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how the project started.
The project started when I finished my thesis and I went traveling in the Western U.S. for a little while. And I came back and I thought I would take some pieces from my thesis and some new pieces that I wrote and make a collection, a whole new collection. I thought, at first it didn't have a title for a while, and then I decided to, it all just came together in a sort of meditative way, and it came together when I was just, I didn't really exactly know what I was looking for in the collection. I just know that I wanted to produce something that I couldn't express in any other way.
Yeah, I know I had some difficulty trying to find a nice genre term for it, and the best I could come up with is it's a beautiful prose meditation.
I like that.
Rather than a short story collection or prose poems or what have you. The pieces sort of defy genre expectations if you're looking for them outside of the text. But as a reading experience, it coheres rather nicely. And one of the things I'm impressed with is The Way Home is a basic and very approachable title, and yet what we actually read in the collection is a little bit challenging and wonderfully bohemian. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way you envisioned the title and its relationship to the material inside the book.
The title I actually took from a piece of writing scratched into the railing of a bridge in New Mexico. I think I was in Taos at the time. I think that's where I was. There were so many things written on that bridge. One was, Johnny loves a lot of girls, which I thought was funny. And I just felt very at home there. And it was just this really good day where I just felt like I was very grounded. I met a tour guide who, in a hot spring later on that day, who told me that a lot of people actually jump off the bridge. He brings people in the river and finds their bodies, like, on the tour. And I just thought about what The Way Home meant, who wrote it and why, and what they may have done. And I felt a very strong connection to that. So I decided that would be the title.
Well, that's really beautiful and honors the other stories that apparently are going on along with your own story on these different journeys.
Mm-hmm.
What was the experience like on that bridge?
It felt very big. Everything just felt really big. And one of the first things I think about when I think of the bridge is this cowboy I saw just walking by in this yellow shirt. He was just walking on the bridge and very relaxed. And I was just wondering where he was going. And a lot of people were there to take photos and visiting, or I don't even know what the word visiting means, honestly. But he was just there in a different way. And I remember that. And I remember the bigness of it and the way the bridge shook whenever a really big car or a truck would come on it. And yeah, I didn't want to leave, but we left to go to the hot springs. So I had to leave. But I really want to go back and just spend a whole day there.
How much graffiti was on the bridge or different things inscribed
on it? Mostly just scratches. A lot. Almost all over.
And so you say this grew out of your thesis.
Yeah, I got my MFA from UCF, and I worked with Susan Hubbard. She was my director, and the thesis is about 3 or 4 parts long, and it details a few different women's lives, and they all come together in some way. I pulled a lot of smaller pieces from there and The Heart of America, and I really focused on the story of kind of one of the protagonists, even though I don't really want that connection to be so overt. I just wanted to kind of express what it feels like to have someone you love die and then have someone you love who's alive want to separate from you. And that was something in my thesis that I wanted to take and put into another type of collection.
Did you see yourself having any sort of literary forebears or any models to work from? Because I can think of a few, but none quite this coherent.
Actually, yeah. I was really inspired the structure of this with the sections and the beginning and how the beginning is kind of broken into sections was inspired by Heather Amy O'Neill's Memory Future. So that's where the structure was inspired from. I really love Molly Gaudry's work. We Take Me Apart is a novel in verse that she wrote. And when I read that, I understood that I could blend lines. I understood that I could blend lines before, but Molly's book really helped me with that. Stephen Graham Jones has been a really big inspiration for me. I think when I read Bleed Into Me for the first time a few years ago, I understood that there were no limits really to what a story could be.
I have to confess, you're alluding to things I don't know about.
It's okay.
So, blending lines, is that what you mean in terms of the sort of prologue and the way that connects everything?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a way of blending lines and just, you know, is this a poem? Is this a story? The midsection called Just a Bunch of Muse Girls Hanging Out in the Desert, like, what is that? I don't know. I wrote it when I just couldn't really think straight. And I just really, a friend of mine, Brooke Elliott, is an artist. And she sent me a photo, and we were talking about pack ratting and what that meant. And I thought that was really interesting. And that, I just remembered thinking of words and just writing. And then, you know, Susan and I went over it. And I went over it again after my thesis was done. I don't know. I kind of like the idea of not being able to call it anything and having that be allowed. At first, I didn't think it was, but as I grew and kept writing and kept learning, I realized that it was allowed.
Not being limited to genre, but instead creating a new genre or a new reading experience.
Yeah. And it's kind of allowed in a way that's not allowed, and I like that. I like that a lot. I like just, it just, it's a really, it feels really good to write that way.
Why is that?
I feel like I could just be myself.
And do you feel like there's something about the experiences you're writing about that sort of demand a new genre? Or is it more just idiosyncratically to your own personality?
I think that there are other writers who blur lines very nicely, like Kim Shinkui. I admire her a lot. Darla Neal, who I worked with too, writes these really beautiful pieces where you don't know if it's poetry or not. It's like, and I just think, I don't know, I just think that's how it comes out sometimes.
Well, it should be freeing to not at least think of the marketplace and, okay, like, I know that very often when I write, part of my brain is going, okay, I just think of cross-sections of journals and what their genre expectations are. And, okay, like, the edgier stuff might go here, and then the more literary stuff might go here. Mm-hmm. And there are occasionally I force myself to write things, and it's like, okay, like, let's not even think about any of that. Let's just see where this goes.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the most satisfying stuff, even if I can't think of where it's going to be published.
Yeah. If I write and think about where it's going to be published too hard, I can't get anything right. So it's helped me not. I mean, I sometimes do. Like, there are really good markets for genre blurring odd pieces. But I don't know. I always told my students not to write for publication. I know a lot of people would disagree with me, but I think if you just write for the love of it and write for what you want to be seeking, and if you always just focus on what you're seeking and don't let go of that, and of course you have to send out your work and like make an effort, but if you just write what you're seeking and really focus on that and honor it, I think, you know, you'll be okay with the rest.
That you'll find an audience.
Yeah, definitely.
Several of the pieces in The Way Home have appeared in journals, and it will be coming out in book form. Could you talk a little bit about the process of making it into a book and finding a publisher?
Yeah, I knew that Dancing Girl Press was right for me. I've sent this book out a few times, actually more than a few times, a lot. I've sent it out a lot, and it got rejected a lot, and that's part of it. And
a proud writing tradition.
Yeah, and, you know, that's okay, and I've revised it since then. I knew that once I read Sheila Squalanti's A Woman Traces the Shoreline by Dancing Girl Press, I knew that I felt at home there in some way that I haven't before with another press or another book even. So I sent there with my fingers crossed, and it was good.
And what is it about them as a publisher that so appeals to you?
I like how they focus on short work that blurs lines, and I love the way Christy Bowen puts together the books, and they're all very beautiful. You know, that's not the most important thing, but I like holding a book, you know. It helps. I like that about her press.
Well, it's not an insignificant thing to consider. It shouldn't be the first thing, but it should be on the list, I do think.
Yeah. So, and they're all handmade by Christy.
Handmade?
Mm-hmm.
Dear Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. She puts a, like, I love it. She's just really dedicated and amazing.
Well, that sounds extraordinary. So I was wondering if you would be willing to read the selection from The Way Home called The Heart of America.
Okay. The Heart of America. You are on Long Island but won't be there forever, only you don't know that yet. It is June. You are 9 years old and your dad takes you to a garage sale a few blocks down from your house. There are rows of everything, rows of Christmas tins, porcelain dolls, records, wicker lawn chairs, rows of silver baskets, cat statues, cassettes, rows of books with pages the color of the moon. In a few years, when you're 14, a big, strong Italian boy will blow on your neck in English class and you will feel violated, but you'll like it. He'll be one of those gold chain-wearing Italians with horses in a hot tub, and even though you're Italian too, you'll still be a stick of a girl with a unibrow who gets rubber bands slung at her in the hallway, who gets called a slut at the Stop and Shop around the corner. He'll blow on your neck again, and you'll still feel violated, but like it even more. Secretly, you'll wish he was a girl. That summer, you will walk past the inactive nuclear power plant near the Long Island Sound, wondering how the brown waves can move in such a fluid, celebratory way, almost like they know how lucky you are. Almost like they know how lucky you are because you are able to push past the ebb and flow, because you are able to leave. So you are 9, and your dad takes you to a garage sale, and you pick out TLC's Crazy Sexy Cool cassette tape, which is greasy and red and smells like cigarettes. He says the tape can be your birthday present because you're his June baby. You tell him you like Left Eye because she raps and you were awful at rapping. He smiles, turns around, and after looking for some time, finds a few 45s. You don't ask him if you can listen. All of his music is the same, warm harmonies and deep voices. When you were 26, old enough to have your own daughter, you will hear some doo-wop music in a Florida diner. You are living there in Florida, and you will hear the music. Yes, you will hear it, and it will be as loud as waves crashing at the Long Island Sound, as loud as fire trucks, as loud as your father's voice when he said, in response of your fear of going to high school, "This is life, goddammit." You will hear the music, and it will be loud, and it will shake you, and you will cry, leaving before your new girlfriend can say, with her feet tapping on the checkerboard floor, "Let's get the special." And then it all hits you as you open the Florida diner double doors, thick southern air coating your skin, making you feel greasy, cheeks flushed red. Your chest tightens, and the sun, yes, the sun, turns everything bright as fire. The metallic diner reflects the bright sun and everything rises, just like the ladder rose, and then everything shrinks. And with everything getting smaller, you feel your body shrinking again too, just like it did when you got out of that damn town. When you are 9 at a June garage sale a few blocks down from your house, you wait for your dad to finish browsing through 45s. And while you're waiting, you get splinters in your fingers from running your hands back and forth across the old wicker chairs that no one will ever buy again. Then you get one last splinter, and this one makes you flinch. So you slip the Crazy Sexy Cool cassette tape in your pocket, telling your father you don't want him to buy it for you anymore. When you are 9, sweating from June, holding your heavy pocket with your young hand, you won't know that you will move to Florida at 16 and become agoraphobic for years, that you will crave fragility and starve yourself to about 70 pounds, that you will crave strength and recover and gain back 30. You won't know that you will end up losing your virginity in college to a woman twice your age, that your dog will die of cancer, that you will win a prize for writing a poem about America. You won't know that you will fall in love with a woman who grows orchids, adopt a child who helps you plant sweet potatoes. You won't know that this woman will be the same woman who never got the chance to say, "Let's get the special," way back at that doo-wop Florida diner. You won't know that you will travel to California and Georgia and Texas and Idaho and Massachusetts and Nebraska. You don't know that your heart will give out and you will die an old, old woman, death being louder and shakier and bulkier and more beautiful than you'd ever have thought. You won't know that you will make it off Long Island. Never again have your neck blown on by an Italian boy who you wish secretly was a girl. Never again have rubber bands thrown at you in the hallway. Never again get called a slut at the Stop and Shop around the corner. Never again go to a June garage sale with your dad. Never again see that dead nuclear power plant shining like a bright gray pearl. You don't know that you will make it out, but you will. You will.
So I'm really impressed at the sort of Proustian way that you sort of create these threads of time, past, present, and even future throughout this collection. and the sense of the journey somehow being connecting all of this time. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the earliest point at which you thought you were going to be a writer.
I knew that I used writing to just help myself move along and understand life and understand things about life probably ever since I was about 12. But in terms of getting into academia and publishing, I didn't think I could do it until I met Jeannie Leiby when I was an undergrad. She was the first person who was like, come intern at the Florida Review. Like, what are you doing leaving the department? You can't leave the department, you know? And I was like, okay, I'll stay. I just didn't really consider it an option until I met her. I did, but I didn't think I could do it. So
Why didn't you think you could do it?
I just didn't think I could. I've never had anyone really believe in me before I met her.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she was like a first literary godparent.
Yeah. I mean, when I was 12, I had a really great English teacher who helped me with that. But in terms of career and all of that stuff, Jeannie really helped me.
And so what were some of your early reading that turned you on to literature or whatever it was that you're reading?
I really loved Francesca Leah Block for a while. I mean, for a very long time. And when I read her work, I read her work when I was about 18, which isn't that long ago, but it feels like forever ago. I read Girl Goddesses No. 9, and there was this one story in it where the devil dogs are like this group of guys, and one of them like sneaks into this girl's window. And I think I'm getting that story right. If I'm not, I have a head full of info right now. But I just remember like reading that book and the first story with Sweet Pea and Peachy Pie. These two girls who are just really free. I really wanted to just have more of a free life because I didn't. And I wanted to be able to feel comfortable with who I was, and I wasn't. And I realized with her books that I could. I really admired her. And before that, I actually really just loved reading everything that Alanis Morissette has ever written. And I remember finding a lot of solace in that. And, you know, I really loved Sylvia Plath from a young age, too.
Everything, or did you – I know a lot of people come to Sylvia Plath from the novel first, which
– Oh, yeah.
The novel. Knowing her career is a little bit strange, but
– Yeah. I really like some of, like, her earlier short stories, which are kind of odd. And I just – I really love the Bee poems. And I think that there's a lot of positivity – that's the wrong word. There's a lot of complex hope in Sylvia's work, a lot of really complex hope that I could identify with. And, you know, I channel her whenever I feel like at all weak. I'm like, I just pretend to be her for a while, which a lot of people can see it, but I feel like that's what I really love about her work.
Yeah. A sort of ruthless honesty.
Yeah. Definitely.
And strength to be willing to just not be liked.
Yeah. Yeah.
For saying things.
I really admire her for that.
I adore Sylvia Plath, and I think that she's one of those writers who has her reputation has suffered so much because the myth of who she is has really culturally outweighed what she's written. Not because of the quality of what she's written, but because of, you know, we just sort of see her picture in the back of the Bell Jar and that sort of sad picture that she writes about where she's being coached to smile when she doesn't want to smile. And unfortunately, I think that's, you know, what we think of her, and that's such a mistake, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
I remember being so impressed hearing her read her poetry.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
I think it's a Cademan collection. And I don't know. She just sounds like a badass New England.
I love that about her. I love the way that she reads. I wish I could read like that.
So I think that we don't, in American letters, we don't give her enough credit. You seemed to defend her strength because I think not many people see her as a strong personality, which I find to be, you know, there seems to be a huge double standard.
Yeah.
When it comes to suicide and when it comes to confessional writers or male writers who commit suicide or who deal with depression long term, we sort of give them a pass, I think. And women writers, that's their story.
I mean, at the same time, while you can say, like, I wish it wasn't her story, it's part of it. And, I mean, that's what she did. There's confusion over whether she meant to or not. And I've talked, to other people about that. But I think whether or not that's part of it or not doesn't take away, like, anything that she's written. You know, it's just, you know, that was a choice that she made. And that's it, you know?
Well, I just, it's one of those things I feel very touchy about because I, you know, Hemingway.
Yeah.
His career is not read retroactively according to his mental illness and according to his suicide. Like, we just give him a total pass. Like, oh, he was just a badass up until the end.
Yeah.
And Sylvia Plath, it seems just like that was her. Anyway, it's a personal thing of mine maybe, but I just.
Yeah, I think.
Anne Sexton, Virginia Woolf,
and Sylvia,
Sylvia Plath. I mean, there's kind of a longish list of women who suffered with mental illness and who committed suicide. And we just – that winds up being their reputation. And I just find that – and these are writers who I adore. You
yeah.
know. And Virginia Woolf seems like such a buddy.
I know. I feel like I just – I think that – I don't know why people focus on – on the suicide of all those women. I don't know why. I probably should, but I don't.
Well, maybe it shouldn't be me trying to make the feminist point about
it.
But you know, T.S. Eliot, you know, had a mental breakdown working on The Wasteland, and we somehow don't say, well, The Wasteland's obviously the ranting of a mentally ill person.
Yeah.
We think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And, you know, we sort of it winds up in the footnotes of the male writers, I think, where it becomes the text of the biography of so many women writers. And I, you know, and the tragedy is, we're not paying enough attention to actually what they wrote.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I don't know, I think that, I think Sylvia would have been just as successful if she kept living. I think about that a lot ever since I took this class and I got into an argument with a few people about it. It wasn't bad. I just think.
Oh, they thought that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think she would have it because I think who knows what would have happened.
But the idea is the legend is because she killed herself. Well, that's bullshit.
Yeah, it is.
my academic and intellectual opinion is that's bullshit.
I agree.
And she was so wonderfully honest. I just remember in the Bell Jar, you know, and her boyfriend says, look at me naked. And then she just describes it and like his testicles are turkey waddles. And
it's
like, if you're not in the mood, then it's really not necessarily the prettiest picture. And I just remember thinking like just the balls of her writing that is just so, so wonderful. I wasn't the guy, so it didn't hurt my feelings.
I loved in that book too how Esther was so honest about not being able to read. That was a part of the book that stood out to me too. And just like the way Sylvia portrayed that within Esther was really just hard to do. I feel like all those like little details. And the detail about the vodka is probably my favorite. I think it will always be when
what detail
when
is
Esther
that?
Drinks the vodka and she says it makes her feel like a sword swallower.
Wow. Well, I feel like I got schooled on the drinking in the Bell Jar.
Yeah.
Kudos. Could you talk more about your undergrad experience and or did you do more writing? Well, I presume you did more writing in your MFA work. But when did your creative writing begin?
When I was an undergrad, it was my minor. And then I decided to make it my major after trying to pursue a journalism major for a while, and it just wasn't working out. I switched to a journalism minor and did photo editing for the newspaper here. And then I just made creative writing my major. I could take all the classes I wanted. I really wanted to keep working with the same professors, so I stayed for grad school. I felt like my time definitely wasn't up. So.
And so who did you work with?
I worked with Susan Hubbard and Darla Neal and Terry Thaxton. And, you know, I worked with Toni Jensen when she was here. And Lisa Roney too. Gosh, of course, Judith Hemschmeyer, Jeannie Leiby. I hope I'm not leaving anyone out.
So what was the experience like?
It was just, I felt like I finally had a place to grow, that I felt comfortable. I just felt like I had a place to grow. And I remember going to Lisa Roney's office. It was like my first week of grad school. And I was like, I can't do this. This is too hard. I'm intimidated by everybody. And I'm terrified. And she goes, well, just keep going. It's fine. Everyone feels this way. And I was like, I don't even know if I want to teach. I don't know if I'm smart enough. And I just thought I was going to do like a total career overhaul and drop out. And she was like, just give it like a semester. And I did. And I just felt a lot better about it all after the first semester was over.
I'm terrified that my students will learn how little I know. So Lisa's really great at, yeah. I think, trying to make the university an inhabitable place.
Yeah, I really love her.
And so I'm relatively new to UCF, and I work for the rhetoric department, so I don't really know that much about the program. So how long is the program?
It's 2 years, and I worked with Jocelyn Parkevicus too. And she was the head of the program, and, you know, it's about 2 years long. So, and I did summers too, so that's how long it took me to graduate. A lot of it is workshopping, and you get to know everyone really well. And that was another reason why I decided to stay. I just really loved the people who were in my class. We got to know each other really well. We went out to dinner every week almost. It was just nice growing with them.
And did that sort of blossom into the sort of Orlando literary scene?
Yeah, it did. Chris Wibiora, who was an undergrad here, and now he goes to Iowa. Yeah, he...
I hear that's pretty good over there.
It's amazing. I'm very proud of him. And Chris, we were at Ed Bull and have been really helpful to me here. And we used to do readings together all the time. And Ed now lives in Atlanta. So I'm kind of the only one left. But I'm not really, because I still have a lot of really great people here who I met through Borough Press, like Ryan Rivas and Nathan Hollick. I've known at UCF too. And
our guest on episode one.
Yeah. And he's been so helpful to me. And then I just kind of fell into all of this when I met Jay Bradley at AWP. And he goes, do you want to be a part of the literary death match? And I said, okay. And then I realized what it was. And I was like, oh, my God.
What is it?
I've never done a public reading really in my life except for at like Natura. And it's a competition that's international. And Todd Zeninga runs it. There are a few judges. And there's two rounds, two authors go, and then two other authors go in through that, two more finish. And I was voted into the final round, which was a blessing. And I had to shoot Jack Kerouac in the mouth with a Nerf dart. And I didn't do it, so I lost to Gregory Sherrill, but he's amazing. So I'm really glad that it was a good loss, because I like Gregory Sherrill a lot. So that was just, I remember thinking, holy crap, what have I gotten myself into? Like, what have I gotten myself into? I had no idea.
Well, it seems like the Orlando literary scene is sort of self-sustaining now. There seems to be, if not activity every night, but there does seem to be regular activity. On Facebook, it just seems like there's always something going on that I'm missing out on.
Yeah. I think with the Kerouac House and with Urban Rethink, and there's so much to do here in terms of Orlando and the literary community. And I don't know, Jesse started There'll Be Words, I think, last year. And it's just taken off, and it's really awesome. And I was asked to do that, too. And I didn't really know how to read in public or how to do any sort of that stuff until I got the opportunity to do those two things. And I asked Curtis Meyer, who was in my first poetry class ever, if he could help me read out loud, because I'm bad at it. And he did. And I remember that. I don't know, it just kind of took off from there, and I consider myself very blessed and very grateful.
So what is your writing process like when you – I know that you have a teaching gig, and that's your day mm-hmm. job. Mm-hmm. But how do you go about writing a new project? Do you have a set schedule?
I don't. I write when I can. That's not – because I can write at any time, but I write when I just feel like I cannot do anything else. That happens more often than others, and I've – learn to let myself compost things. When I don't feel like writing, I could just like write a few words down or like draw something or take a drive or go for a swim in the ocean. And there are times when I just know that I have to write, and then I will.
So an impulsive approach.
Yeah. It wasn't really like that when I was in grad school. It was more of a systematic thing. And now I feel like it feels right to do it like this. So...
what were some of the frustrations during your MFA experience?
I think just learning how to convey what I wanted to convey within a story was really hard. And I feel like I finally hit something right when I wrote this story called Sweeping Back the Ocean. And I remember turning that in and I'm like, is this going to be the same thing? I'm not going to really understand how to communicate like the root of a story. I'm not going to understand how to ground the narrator's pain. I'm not going to understand how to do any of this. And then all of a sudden people got it. And I was like, oh, maybe I don't even know what I did. And then I kept trying to, you know, ground the narrator's like intangible like pain into like the story. And that was hard. And I still have trouble doing that.
What exactly do you mean by grounding?
Just where is the pain coming from? The narrator's really upset. What the hell is going on? You know, just grounding the situation. Also, movement in my stories is really hard. A lot of times, you know, I was taking a workshop with Mary Gateskill, and she goes, this is a good story, but, you know, nothing really happens at the end. She goes, something has to happen. I said, okay. You know, sometimes I have trouble with that, but it's just stuff to keep in mind when I keep writing and revising.
And is it, do you think this comes out of an experimental nature on your part, or is it simply a matter of trying to fulfill the sort of requirements of craft?
I think that I try really hard to listen to my heart when I write, and when I took Mary's suggestion, my story felt better to me, and I felt like I was communicating what I wanted to more clearly. So there's another story that I wrote called Karina's Blue Horse, and that one has a flash forward at the end. And, you know, a few readers have said this story would be better if, or the story would be more clear if the flash forward were taken out. And I'm just like, I don't really want to take the flash forward out. I felt like if I moved around and clarified what came before it, then the flash forward could stay. So that's what I ended up doing. And then it got picked up by an anthology called Love Magic, edited by Francesca Leah Block. So it's hard to know like when to listen to your heart and when to take a step out and really look at the story. I think it's a balance of both. And I think you can do both at the same time.
Well, I know this was a major concern I had, partly, you know, I come from a lit background and I come from a sort of modernist frame of reference where the idea of telling a normal story was sort of regarded as the telling of a lie, that our lives don't necessarily follow the patterns of a story. Schopenhauer argued that our lives do, but yeah, Samuel Beckett certainly saw things in a more existentialist light where it's like, no, it's just a bunch of shit and we're just trying to think our way out of it and we just barely do or maybe we don't.
Yeah.
And so a Beckett play is just sort of stewing in that. And so academically, I studied a lot of novels that sort of just work their way into that problem of how do we know anything?
Yeah.
And, you know, writers are lucky. We're lucky if we understand ourselves.
Yeah. I agree.
And so to populate a story or a novel with a dozen characters or however many characters could create a problem. So, yeah, it's one of those tensions that I feel as a writer. And I think sometimes that makes it difficult for me to tell a normal story because part of my brain is thinking it's a lie.
Yeah.
I'm just creating a convenient fiction.
I think that, like, thinking your way out of something is a really interesting way to put it. I try to feel my way out of stories. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. I don't know. I feel like the way that I know how to communicate is through something a bit more genre bending.
Well, and I do like a well-told story, so it's not exactly
me
like
too. I feel like it's funny because when I wrote Karina's Blue Horse, a friend of mine said, you know, this is a straightforward story. You did it. You told a straightforward story until the end. And I realized, like, you know, I was kind of happy that I was able to tell a straightforward story. And for a while, I didn't really know what to do at the end. And it was hard to like figure that one out. But, you know, it's nice to be able to just tell a straightforward story. And that's really hard for me.
And it's not selling out.
Like, it's definitely not.
I don't know what selling out means exactly.
I think that maybe selling out means when you stop seeking and when you just lose sight of why you're writing altogether. As long as you know why you're writing and as long as you're honest with yourself as to why you're writing something, I think it's not selling out. Yeah.
Rod Stewart maybe doing the classic American songbook. Maybe that's selling out.
Well, he might have been seeking money.
Well, I'm sure that was the case.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The term selling out seems to suggest we have so much control over everything. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to do something the public will want and it'll just be easy. Like, and I don't know that that's the case.
Yeah, I think sometimes that's what people want to do, though, you know?
So what was it like after the MFA experience? Because I know that's usually a big letdown because you tend to lose your community. And...
Yeah, I did lose my community. And we've kept in, you know, we've kept in touch. We've, a lot of us have stayed friends. And I think the hardest part for me was to understand that I can still be, I consider myself just, I feel at home in a lot of different places. And I like to drive. I like to go places. And I hesitate to use the word travel. I used to use it a lot, but now I just feel like I like the word travel, but maybe not visit. I don't know. When I go places, a lot of people say, are you living here or are you just visiting? And I'm like, well, I'm living here today. I'm living here today.
I'm not dead yet.
Yeah. Yes. I think it's all living. And that's something that I love about life and experience. And I don't want to lose that. You know, I traveled when I was in grad school. I did it cheaply, luckily, and I traveled when I was out of grad school, and that was something I was very afraid of losing. I was afraid of just losing the family I made. When I got out of grad school, I just felt really lost. I mean, I still definitely don't have it all figured out. But, you know, darling, Neil and I talk sometimes, and she goes, you don't need grad school anymore. You're fine. And I'm like, I just have to keep on listening to her so I don't miss it so much.
Well, and ultimately, you know, it's about us and the words and finding an audience. And
yeah.
It's a hell of a thing when you lose that crowd that you got. But I think part of being a writer is you write even when you don't have that.
Yeah, definitely. And I still have my readers. You know, Ed and I read each other's work. And, you know, occasionally, like, I would like to more often send my work to other people who I graduated with. And we're all just kind of trying to find our way. We all keep in touch, which is nice. I think if I ever did go back for another MFA, it wouldn't be the same. But at the same time, it's just something that I miss a lot.
So you mentioned that one of your minors was photojournalism.
Mm-hmm.
And you're one hell of a photographer.
Thank you.
Are you inclined to incorporate that into your writing?
I don't do that much. Just because I feel like I'm so close to both of them, it's hard for me to put them together. A story that I wrote for Smoke Long called Inside, I paired it with one of my photos that I took. And that was probably the first time I've ever done that. And then with Borough Press, I wrote an essay about being in New Mexico and California. I did two of those, and both have my photos. You know, that's rare for me to do that, but I felt comfortable enough doing that. Karen Prosen shot the book cover for The Way Home. And I told her, you know, I can't see the book cover. I just don't know how to do that. So I think you should do it. I just love the way that she sees the world. Her photographs are beautiful. And she took a really good cover. And it was just perfect. And I feel like, you know, she read the book and I was like, just... And it was nice to have another person involved.
And you trusted her with it.
I did. Yeah, completely.
But for you, taking photographs is so complete an experience that you're not thinking, okay, how can I use this and blend it? And
I feel like it's just different. It's like a whole different, like, part of my brain. Not really, but it's just a different, like, part of life or something.
This week, which will be far in the past, probably by the time that this interview airs, you did Poetry Cover Night at Urban Rethink.
Yeah.
Yes. What was that like? And tell us about the future of that.
I was reading Marilyn Hacker's Love, Death, and the Changing of the Seasons. I read this one poem called Wagers, and I thought, this would be fun to read out loud. I wish I wrote it. You know, I wish I could read it out loud more so than I wish I wrote it. And I had that in my head for a while. And I was doing a reading for Bethany DeVall's art opening at Rhapsodic, and I decided to read two other Marilyn Hacker poems at that one as cover poems. And then I was talking to Ryan Rivas. And I don't know what we were talking about. I don't remember, but I just said, how about we can have a cover poem night? And he said, that sounds like fun. And I said, okay. And I told Pat Green, who's the, I forget his title a lot, events coordinator at Urban Rethink. And he put it up on the site. And he put this photograph that he took of me when I was working at an oxygen bar with his cell phone up on it. And I was like, okay. And I was like, I was very happy and grateful that the Urban Rethink wanted to put it on. And I just kind of figured a few people would come and it wouldn't be that big of a deal. It would be fun, but maybe like 10 or 15. And then all of a sudden, the Weekly picked up and the Sentinel advertised it. And people who I have never met before were there. People who were brand new, I think, to the Orlando Lit community were there. And it was just really nice. It was just like, I was not expecting it. I wasn't expecting like any of it to happen. So I want to have more. And probably we're going to do it monthly or every other month, depending.
Depending on you and...
Depending on Urban Rethink and what they would like to do, because we haven't really talked about that yet.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. How many readers participated?
There were a lot. I don't know, maybe like 30. Like, I don't know. I'd have to count on the sign-up sheet, but there were a lot of people there. And it was just so nice to see people read a piece and perform it. It was just so interesting to see who everyone picked. We had Robbie Ramirez did a poetry version of Beck's Loser. And that was awesome. That was awesome. That's not what I intended for cover poetry to be, but it could be anything. You know, you could make a song into a poem and perform it, you know?
Well, and I think Beck at different points has been very poetic.
Definitely.
But yeah. His music is so goofy. I mean that in the
That's
nicest way.
That's what we were talking about at the reading. Robbie goes, I don't know why. I can always remember lyrics that don't make any sense.
Well, yeah. I remember he introduced the White Stripes at one of the
yeah.
award shows. And his introduction to them was just, one, the White Stripes didn't need any introduction. But
yeah.
And so, like, okay, they've won awards. They're good. And so he just gave this sort of crazy-ass poem as this introduction.
Yeah.
Just a sort of random images that seemed to convey what their music was about that did a lot better, I think, to sort of invoke the spirit. So, you know, I think he deserves more credit than he probably gets because his music is so funny and so clever.
I'm glad that Robbie covered that.
Well, and I guess it's also, it sounds like a wonderful event in the future. I will be going, but it sounds like a wonderful event because it's, I know when people have open mic poetry nights and things like that, that it just becomes very insular. Like, we're here to celebrate each other's poetry and affirm each other's poetry, which very often is about the people involved and not necessarily poetry itself.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so when people are bringing poems that they love, I think a lot of the pressure is off to like it. And so it's more of a, I think you're more open, perhaps.
Yeah.
To just the experience because, you know, the sort of rhetorical situation is a little bit more relaxed.
Mm-hmm. I definitely felt like that. Everyone seemed to be having just a lot of fun, and it was really laid back, more so as the night went on. It was just a really, at the end of the night, it was just a bunch of people having fun. You know, we stopped using the microphone at one point, and it was just, yeah.
Well, and I think we should be having more fun with poetry.
I agree.
I really agree. It shouldn't be in this, museum.
Definitely not.
Well, it was so great to talk to you. You know, I've met you earlier, but I think this is by far the longest chat we've had so far.
Definitely.
And so I look forward to future events and keep writing, and I'll keep reading.
Thank you.
And now for something that is not the last thing we just did.
The Fall of the House of Corman by Randall Berling. Roger Corman's films remind me of the Promise Keepers, the coalition of Christian men who zealously huddled together in stadiums to reaffirm their manliness and regain their control on the American family. I reluctantly admire the Promise Keepers for being devout and holding true to their convictions, just as I hesitantly admire the zeal of Corman, who inexplicably regards his work as a divine revelation of the artist's mind. Before I progress too far, I must confess that what follows strays far from my original intentions, as all too often is the case when a writer begins to bare his intellect. You see, or perhaps you don't for the moment, I had planned for months to travel up the East Coast to visit the national monuments dedicated to Edgar Allan Poe. I had earned an MA in English 2 years earlier, and I wanted to make a pilgrimage to the grave of the man I spent so many hours writing a thesis about. I imagined myself stopping in Baltimore, placing a red rose on Poe's grave, and then driving over to Old O'Bricky's for a double helping of Maryland crab cakes. My idea was to stop at Hagerstown, Maryland for the night, see Antietam in the morning, then drive straight to Baltimore for my homage to Poe. When my blue 1997 Saturn pulled into Hagerstown, a minor heart of the trucking industry laced with artery-like superhighways, around 8 o'clock p.m., it was dark as ink and raining. Perfect atmosphere to curl up in the Quality Inn and read The Black Cat, or maybe Laisha. The desk clerk looked incredulous and rude when I said I wanted a room and had no reservation. Several hundreds of thousands of promise keepers, without much warning, had swarmed all over the mid-Atlantic states, filling hotels within 100 miles of Washington, D.C. for their summit the next morning. While these righteous happy men were hugging each other, laughing, carrying their bags in out of the rain, I stood there helpless, my Library of America edition of Poe soaking under my armpit. I drove another 4 hours south that night, ending up deep in Virginia, so exhausted that I could barely see the road when I finally stopped. I never made it to Baltimore, where those happy promise-keeping men caused traffic jams for days around the D.C. area, so close to Poe's grave. By that time, I cared so little, just wanting to collapse on the rock-hard mattress and grab a few winks before the unforgiving sun would shine through my window. I rolled several times in the plywood-like bed, my back aching from the drive and my eyes pried wide open from the 3 cups of Java I guzzled on the road. Too jittery to read, I cursed as I fumbled for the TV remote. No cable, but Channel 63 was on the air. I spent some of my childhood in Virginia, and one of my fondest memories from that time is watching Channel 63 on the weekends. The channel would play 4 old horror and science fiction movies every Friday night, and repeat them Saturday and Sunday afternoons in case you either missed them or had an obsession. I waited with anticipation for the commercial to end. It was midnight, and if my guess was right, the next movie might be going to start. Ultimately, I was right, but the movie didn't just start. First, a lame Elvira-esque hostess named Tasha, the Tart of Terror, announced the start of WHOR Channel 63's second feature of their Roger Corman Fright Night, The Pit and the Pendulum. And I watched and I watched and I wonderingly watched. As Corman sees it, The Pit and the Pendulum does not entail a victim of the Inquisition suffocating with overwhelming terror in a torture chamber, wondering which death is worse, being slowly halved by the blade of the pendulum or being excruciatingly devoured by rats in an abysmal pit. Corman instead tells the convoluted story of a man, played by Vincent Price, driven mad with guilt over burying his wife alive. But the wife, he learns, actually only feigned that death to murder him, and consequently, Vincent does go insane with jealousy and believes he is his uncle. The uncle years earlier had caught his wife cuckolding him with his brother and killed them both, all under the eyes of Vincent as a child, who of course repressed the memory. There is no psychological terror of a man about to die in Corman's The Pit and the Pendulum. And come to think of it, there is no pit or pendulum, except as an insignificant afterthought at the film's end. There is barely a pit and pendulum in the film. Few writers know as much as Poe about the inner workings of the human psyche, or what lies beneath the darkness of that moment between wakefulness and sleep. But what Corman doesn't know about it could flood the mid-Atlantic states with cheerful Christians. Corman translates Poe's psychological insights into phony cobwebs, creaky stairs, and monstrous castles that tremble with age, or maybe shoddy construction. Lost in the translation is the terror that lies within the mind. As the credits scrolled up my television at 2 o'clock a.m., Tasha's voiceover announced the next execrable treat, Corman's Edgar Allan Poe's Tales of Terror, a delightful trio of Poe tales in half-hour segments. I groaned, rolling to my side as I pounded the remote's off button. But a half hour later, I still could not escape the caffeine still pulsing through my veins. Click. Light flooded the room. Corman's mockery of Poe crackled back onto the television. Part 2 of Edgar Allan Poe's Tales of Terror had just started. The segment began with a drunken Montresor, a whiny Peter Lorre, who matches wine-tasting wits with Fortunato. Sounds quite like the cask of Amontillado, does it not? Well, really, Corman would have us know that this scenario is The Black Cat, originally a tale of acute senses that drove the narrator homicidally mad and whose murders were revealed by a black cat walled up with his wife's corpse. In this black cat, Montresor is a lush whose nag of a wife ends up moonlighting with the same Fortunato who brought home the drunken Montresor. Of course, he discovers their affair and through his jealous rage, Poe never concerned himself with jealousy, plots his revenge to brick both of them into the wall of his basement. The titular cat is the giveaway when the police arrive, but there is none of the promised terror in the so-called Edgar Allan Poe's Tales of Terror. I could not help laughing like a goon as the drunken Montresor stumbled and sweated while hallucinating over campy ghost images of his walled-up victims. In Poe's The Cask of Amontillado, Montresor seeks revenge from insult, not cuckoldry, and it is his cleverness and detached emotions that enhance the terrifying drama of the tale. With his inadvertent comedic success, Corman's funnier choices from Poe would have been The Premature Burial, King Pest, or even The Literary Life of Thingum Bob Esquire, although the satire would most likely be lost on Corman. As the police carried the pathetic Montresor away in classic Keystone Cops fashion, I grabbed the ice bucket, fumbled for some quarters from my suitcase, and headed for the vending machines. Up for good now, I needed something to help stomach Corman's movies. As the ice machine ground out a bucket full of cubes, I pondered over what I had just watched. My brain raged at the crazy alterations in the plots. When Corman and screenwriter Richard Matheson include EAP's name in a film, the viewer should expect to see something of what Poe wrote. I'm not opposed to plot changes, even radical ones, in film adaptations of literature. Most works need significant changes to convey moods normally revealed through a character's thoughts. But change should realize the themes in the literature, not efface them. I think of the recent film of The Scarlet Letter, with Demi Moore as Hester Prynne. The changes in that film lowered Hawthorne's novel to a 16th century version of Melrose Place. Nothing remained of the critique of the Puritan society and moral hypocrisy that shunned the mother of an illegitimate child and led to the withering of her lover's soul. Director Roland Joffe, in a thrilling Corman-esque move, decided that Hawthorne was wrong, that guilt went out in the 1960s, and that Hester's real story was her sexual awakening and overcoming a patriarchal society. Demi Moore, also showing symptoms of the Corman, wanted to say more these and thous than the script called for because she felt they sounded romantic. By the time of the Roger Corman Fright Night, I was already well acquainted with the lunacy of Corman's plot changes. The first Corman-Poe adaptation I saw was Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, based on the poem of a man in his study lamenting his loss while a raven tells him he will nevermore see his love again. But there is no sense of longing. The focus in Corman's version, the revenge of one magician against another. A magician in The Raven? You don't say. I have to admit that Corman's The Fall of the House of Usher well depicted the decay of the physical mansion as a reflection of the Usher lineage. It is already 3:30 a.m., and nearly 2 hours left of Tasha's night of torturing me, so why not admit such things? However, Corman still managed to neglect the most crucial element of the story, the decay's origins. Poe subtly hints that incest may represent the root of the rotting tree, a tree branching exclusively to one side. In the film, the Usher family had always been comprised of rogues and cutthroats, rapists and murderers. A family tree full of bad karma that rots its branches as they spread. Poe's allegations of disturbing taboos are lost in Corman's production, but the special effects of the house, though campy, are effective. Other films are not as well put together in set or direction. Mystery Science Theater 3000 has lampooned numerous Corman films. I felt an uncontrollable urge to MST Corman's Poe movies as I watched them. Watching them silently, receptively, is more than anyone can be asked to bear. As Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher was a complex tale of horror beyond merely that of incest, so predictably Corman's painfully simple Usher must be but gratuitously related to the original. Poe's tale spends a third of its pages focusing on the narrator's thoughts as he approaches the house, so that the story is as much about him as the acutely sensed Usher. But instead of Poe's narrator visiting his sick friend Roderick, Corman makes the visitor the fiancé of Roderick's sister. Corman thought it more dramatic, I suppose, to have the fiancé become Usher's antagonist, having the two men duking it out over who would keep her. Roderick wins the struggle, and for some reason, buries his sister alive, leaving the fiancé to frantically, read comically, search around the house for her casket to save her from suffocating. Then Madeline somehow becomes a zombie and tries to strangle anyone within reach, who more often than not is Roderick. But who can blame her? To go on would be to relive the horror, the non-suspenseful and non-psychological, non-intensity of Corman's anemic efforts to recast Poe stories as films. The meaning of Poe's bizarre writings has always been close to inexpressible, which is why the meaning of Poe's writings must be virtually unfilmable. especially for the caliber of filmmaker who, besides these Poe atrocities, brought us The Killer Leeches, It Conquered the World, and Teenage Cavemen. As for me, I slept through the rest of the Roger Corman Fright Night and woke late, almost missing checkout time. My elegy to Poe would have to wait, perhaps with a return in January, in time to honor EAP's birthday, which I am proud to say is also my own.
The House of the Fall of Corman was read by Nathan Holland.
And now, the Drunken Odyssey mailbag.
This week we have two items of mail. The first comes from Jamie Hecker, who's a dear friend and fellow contributor to Celebrations magazine, who asks, how organic is the outline process of writing? Outline, research, modify, outline? How does it vary from writer to writer, fiction versus nonfiction? The only correct answer, of course, is you must outline or else you are a bad person. This is a subject that's come up rather often on this podcast, and a consensus of writers seem to say avoid outlining because that will make your storytelling too rigid, too empty, too formal, too something. The fear is that the story will be a foregone conclusion and then characters are merely puppets who are dragged throughout the scenes. The idea is you should just write and see where the story goes. And I think for a lot of younger writers of fiction, of novels, I think this is actually advice that maybe is not the most helpful, especially if those writers are keen on literary fiction. The reason why I say this is because I have seen so many young writers who get so thrilled and wrapped up in building the world that their fiction is set in that the story, the forward momentum, what John Updike called the forward tilt of suspense, gets lost or never was there to begin with. Writers very often see their characters' stories not as linear narratives, but as lifelong epics, including flashbacks and flash forwards, and what happens is the story just winds up never actually being present. If the focus is everywhere, then the focus is essentially nowhere. And I think the advice not to outline, not to stress that stuff, is from some impulse to not overthink storytelling, but for people who can't help but overthink storytelling, outlining, I think, can help keep a sense of focus. You know, just keeping track of what does the character want at the beginning of the chapter, what has happened to that desire at the end of the chapter, and then beginning the next chapter with some other desire or some related desire. But just figuring out how each chapter, where the momentum is coming from, and reminding yourself and reminding the reader of that regularly as you write is really, really important. And if you need to write an outline to make that happen, go right ahead. You know, any good writer, if you wind up writing something better than your outline had predicted, then you go with what you wrote anyway. As for nonfiction, I don't have much good advice. Usually when I write a story, I've got an idea of the story I think I'm going to write, and then I do the research, and then I go ahead and write it, and sometimes it's more or less like I thought, and other times I wind up surprised. It also has a lot to do with how much room you have to write in. And so a nonfiction book, and I've never written one, I mean, I did write a book-length dissertation on modern characterization. I know you're all dying to read that one. But I've not written what most people would consider a nonfiction book to be, so I don't know how that would work. You know, I've written a proposal for one with an outline, but I haven't done the research, which means that there could be entirely different levels of the story that I haven't even seen yet. So presumably my outline would change, and possibly the entire focus of the book could change as well. Our second letter comes from Anne Zimmerman Reich. She observes there's been a lot of talk about new masculinity, and she wants to know, what would Hemingway say and all that, and what about new media literary representations of femininity, Princess Merida, Katniss Everdeen? Okay, let's unpack some of this. I guess what might be called the new masculinity dates back kind of to the 90s. In 1990, the poet Robert Bly published Iron John, a Book About Men, which sort of in a Joseph Campbell way read the myth in a way that was meant to offer some sort of social answers and social reassurance about the role of men. And I think this was also kind of a response to the, how can I put this, the wealth of language that was developed through the work of feminism in order to describe the female experience. Now, we live still in a patriarchal culture, and so women had to find various ways to describe what their experience was like, whereas men did not really have to describe what their experience was like since they were dominant. They simply had to be, whereas women had to deal with all these extra pressures and through all those frustrations, and also just learning how to talk about themselves. You know, it required kind of a radical approach. Virginia Woolf talks about this wonderfully in A Room of One's Own, where I forget exactly what the order is. I might get this wrong, but Virginia Woolf comes across a sentence in a book that says, Daphne liked Chloe. And the idea of a woman liking another woman, and this wasn't explicitly sexual or anything like that, just the idea of what a woman thought and cared about without a man being somehow essential to the equation seemed revolutionary to her. Not the fact that a woman could like another woman, but that someone wrote it down. For so long, you know, women were represented by men, and men were not really represented by women. However, this may sound like a dodge. And so I think what Robert Bly was doing around 1990, when feminism was really, really cooking, was to say, look at all of this extraordinary work that women are doing to describe their experience, and men don't necessarily have that. They can describe their experience, but it's not really gender-coded. And so he was striving to find a way for men to find dignity in their own masculinity. Whereas, generally in our culture, masculinity is either taken as a given or not accepted. So it's a very binary either-or thing and doesn't really have much texture to it. And so it seems to me, I haven't really looked too carefully into this, but the new masculinity seems to be about this desire to describe what masculine experience is like on its own terms. And my take on it, you know, I don't know that Hemingway would take time out of his very busy, active masculine life to offer much explicit commentary or philosophizing about these things. You know, his best ideas wound up in his fiction. And I do think, actually, that if he's read properly, that Hemingway does offer so much for men to understand about the nature of being a man, and it's not all positive. And I'm sure, you know, were Bob Lamb on the show, he could do a wonderful job explaining this better than I can. But here's the thing. There are two places you can go to learn a lot about this. Ironically, one of them is queer theory. Queer theory puts forth a few ideas, one of which is that sexual orientation is more of a spectrum than a binary thing. That we are not completely straight, that we are not completely gay, that we are some variation thereof, and or some mixture. And there is a great pressure that society places on us, that we place on each other, in order to live up to some sort of binary expectation. This is why, up until fairly recently, people were not really accepting that they were gay, or, you know, having, they would have straight families and, you know, in middle age, just go, fuck it, this is my life, this isn't who I am. And some people just being closeted their whole life. And this is still going on. Hi, Marcus Bachman. Hi. I feel like I'm digressing. One of the other elements, though, of queer theory, and this is, I think, really, really valuable for men, is the idea of the pressure to be heterosexual and what that does to friendships. We have decided that so many behaviors are gay in our culture that men are actually terrified to be really good friends with another buddy. This is one of the reasons why men love sports. It's a way to triangulate emotion without actually feeling emotion for another man. See, it sounds kind of gay just talking about that, doesn't it? To say that I have man friends, that I have man friends whom I love. There are men in this world who I love. It's not a sexual thing. Well, not especially. But it is almost forbidden for men to actually talk like this and explore these things and express their feelings for other men. Whereas if, you know, a woman has a woman friend and they get along wonderfully, well, you know, they're just, they can talk about it, they can lavish in it, where, you know, if men start hanging out too often, sooner or later, just go ahead and fuck each other is what people are going to be joking and pointing out, because the idea of just men being friends is threatening. It threatens the binary. Men are supposed to be alpha males. They beat up other men and they collect women. That is their role. So queer theory is a really important way, I think, that men can sort of see where the pressures are coming from so that they can see how limited their lives are culturally because of all these pressures. You know, you're not allowed to do this. Why? That would be gay. A real man wouldn't do that. And I'm sure I've been guilty of this sort of thing. But there's one other place that's really valuable to look, and that is the work of stand-up comedians. In particular, I think of Louis C.K., I think of Bill Maher, and I think of Chris Rock. Those three comedians definitely express what the male point of view is like. And they do so in ways that are revelatory. Seldom does it make men look good, but these comics, and comedy really is not about just making people giggle. Comedy is about getting us to recognize things in life that are uncomfortable. Anyway, I don't mean to get into a whole philosophy of humor here, but it is really important to me that, you know, you do at least think about the idea of comedy being not just about laughing, not just about, you know, some entertaining bit of fluff, but rather comedy as an art form, comedy as serving a deep cultural purpose. Wow, this answer is more than 5 minutes. I guess I lied at the beginning of the show. And so one of the things that these comics do point out is that men are much simpler than women make them out to be, and that men have relentless drives. And I realize that I also picked on Bill Maher early in the show, but he is one of my, the word hero, I think, would be, well, yes, clearly overdoing it, but he's done plenty of work that I admire, and he's given me a lot to think about over the years. And so one of his bits that I remember quite well is the idea of, you know, all these women's magazines trying to figure men out, and they're just very imaginative. Oh, 93 ways to drive your man crazy in bed. And Bill Maher said something to the effect of, actually, there's just one way. It's called a blowjob. Do it 93 times. Men are not that complicated, but women very often will imagine their lover, their mate. That imaginatively, while they're going about their day, even if they're not with their mate, they are imagining that they are with their mate, or they will take some trifle that was said by their mate and they will create elaborate narratives. Sex and the City actually treated this really well. Very often in Sex and the City, I shake my head at how little the characters and the writers seem to understand about straight men. Of course, it's a show written by gay men for, you know, and starring straight women. Well, that's not even true, since Cynthia Nixon turns out not to be straight, which is very, very cool. All right, I'm really losing the thread here. Can you tell I'm exhausted, people? Anyway, but they had an episode, and, you know, it led to a book because this one insight was so valuable it had legs. It was just, he's just thought that into you. Oh, well, the man said this, and it could mean this, or it could mean that. Really, we're not that hard to figure out. We don't think about our feelings much. We don't talk about our feelings much. We are actually punished when we do so. And yet women expect men to reverse this when they're in a relationship with them. This causes a lot of friction. All right, now I don't mean to go down that John Gray road of men are from Mars and women are from Venus. He's clearly a quack, although he's not completely wrong to see that there is a major difference between men and women in how they approach life. And I don't mean to be essentialist here. I hope you understand this, dear listeners. I don't mean all men or all women. You know, I do think of also Jane Hamilton, the novelist who I heard in a Q&A, someone asked her, why do you write so many male characters? And she said, I like to think that the similarities between men and women are greater than the differences between men and women. And that may be true. I don't mean to overblow the differences between men and women, but it is, I think, a crucial thing to at least try to see and to try and understand, not to make it a crude binary thing, but to try and, you know, have more insight and to not always struggle so much to figure out what's going on when sometimes what's going on is very, very simple. Just recently, I saw on The Louis Show, his TV show, this was season 3, episode 3, he goes to Miami and he winds up befriending a lifeguard, and they basically have to break up at the end of the episode because of these pressures. And Louis C.K., I don't know if he's read Queer Theory, but basically that episode illustrates the second idea of Queer Theory that I pointed out, which is all the pressures that society places on us, that we place on each other. And he does this. It's so fucking funny, folks. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend you check it out. He and this lifeguard, they can't even have the conversation about what's going on between them when what's going on between them is they're two pretty good guys and they're friends. That shouldn't be that hard. And yet they can't even get the words out. And it's the conversation they have is just filled with vague phrases and pronouns without reference. And then they'll start to say something and then they cut each other off so that they don't actually have to go down any road of semiotic pursuit, because that could become a path of danger. And so I think these male comics do express what men think very often in ways that are not socially appropriate. That is, I think, the other major thing to understand about male psychology is it's generally not socially appropriate at all. Men basically want to have sex with almost every single woman who seems, I don't know, viable. So like half the women in existence, men want to have sex with at all times. When does that go away? When you're in a committed relationship? No. When you're married? No. When you're old? No. And this has nothing to do with the way men behave. Men don't have to behave badly. But men do have to think badly. Or at least I do. And just about every man I've met does. Well, I don't know if this is coherent at all. Oh, what's that, Lauren?
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
All right, keep your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.
You complete me. You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not. Even if you'd like to be. To them, you're just a freak. Like me. They need you right now. When they don't, they'll cast you out. Like a leper. See, their morals, their code. It's a bad joke. I'm dropped at the first sign of trouble. They're only as good as the world allows them to be. I'll show you. When the chips are down, these civilized people, they'll eat each other.
Ooh, I'm chilled to the bones. Why don't you give me some wine? Well, don't just stand there gaping at me.
That voice, I...
Will you give me some wine?
Yes, yes.